Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. This is The Big Picture and this is AB Dawji. Ahlan wa sahlan and how's it? Kullu tamam, Habibi? Well, no time for small talk, no time for chit-chat. Lots of work to get through. So, let's get on with the show. And as usual, first the light stuff. In the category of Tatama Chance, we have a winner. He takes the cake. A first-class chancer. Now, here is his story. But first, dear listeners, a question. What does it mean if you committed a terrible crime and were sentenced to life imprisonment? It's clear. You will stay in Tronk until you are dead. That's it. Very simple and very clear. But one bright fellow decided to interpret this in a different way. 66-year-old Benjamin Schreiber was sentenced to life in prison without parole for killing a man with the handle of an axe in 1996. Then, this is what happens. In March 2015, Mr. Schreiber, who is being held at the Iowa State prison, was taken to a hospital after having a seizure and a high fever, according to his petition, that is to the courts. The cause of his illness turned out to be large kidney stones, which led to septic poisoning. When he lost consciousness at the University of Iowa's hospital and clinics, a staff member called his brother, who told the hospital that although it could give Mr. Schreiber medicine to ease his pain, otherwise you are to let him pass, according to this petition that Schreiber made to the court. What's this all about the courts here now? Well, Mr. Schreiber's heart stopped, and the medical team managed to revive him. And that's when our genius decided to go to court and ask to be freed. Now, his argument was that since his life came to an end, therefore, technically, his imprisonment for life had also ended at that point. And therefore, he should be released from prison. Wow, what a brilliant argument. But that's not what Judge Amanda Potterfield thought. She told him to footsack. Well, she didn't actually use that word. She said Schreiber is either still alive, in which case he must remain in prison, or he is actually dead, in which case this appeal is moot, meaning there's nothing to discuss. Well, there you are, folks. A first-class Tatama Chancer. Or as it is described in Hebrew, chutzpah. Now, let me repeat the word chutzpah. Spelt, this is how you spell it. C-H-U-T-Z-P-A-H. C-H-U-T-Z-P-A-H. Now, be careful how you pronounce that word, okay? What does it mean? What does this word mean? Well, let me give you an example. A young fellow shoots and kills his parents. He appears in court and tells the judge, "Please have mercy on me, my lord. I am an orphan." Now that guy has got real chutzpah. Ridiculously daring. You got it? Right? You learnt a new word today. Chutzpah. And speaking about really real daring, or maybe real anger, a family was fed up that Old Mutual did not pay out the funeral insurance of their dead relative. So two women carried the corpse in a body bag and took it to the branch of the bank. The whole episode was videoed and broadcast on social media. People were very cross with the insurance company for treating people like this. Old Mutual very quickly got a scrick and immediately paid out and apologized and said that this should not have happened. It's like a mistake and it was unacceptable and that 99% of claims are paid within 8 hours, wagera, wagera, wagera. Now, I really admire these two ladies who took the corpse in. They really took the bull by the horns or maybe elsewhere. Okay, Let's move now to India. Oh, by the way, I've got a magic trip to India and Kashmir departing on the 20th of next month. And the good news is that there are still some seats left. So hurry, hurry, hurry and call me. 082-352-3526. Or if you didn't get that number quickly, just Google my name. And, dear listeners, when you are in India and Kashmir, there are such amazing sights to see. The Taj Mahal, the beautiful Dal Lake in Kashmir, ringed with snow-covered majestic mountains. And, of course, the huge variety of fabulous food. A gastronomic delight. I have eaten amazing food at amazing restaurants. But everyone will caution you before you go to India. Don't ever eat the street food, food from the stalls in the streets. Because if you do, then you will suffer from what is known as, well, it's a technical medical term called gurgur. Your stomach will be like a washing machine. And as it is popularly known, you will have Delhi belly or violent diarrhea, or in my words, serious spray painting. But you know, some people still take a chance and have some appetizing little treats like bel puri from a street vendor. Now, having said all that, I wonder whether anyone of you who's going to India will try this. And let me read from the British Guardian newspaper. It says, the tantalizing scent of freshly cooked dough rises from Brij Bihari Rice food stall outside Patna Zoo. Sitting on top of the grill is rice speciality, Litti Chokha, stuffed wheat flour balls tossed in ghee and served with mashed aubergine or potato on the side. But there is another ingredient. Rice says, that is essential to the dish's distinctive flavor. Something that gives this Litti Chokha a special flavor. He said, cow dung flame, smoke and ashes add a special taste to this dish, and that's why food lovers rush to our stalls to relish the food. Yet, rye is one of about 5,000 street vendors in Patna, the capital of Bihar state, who say their livelihoods are under threat. After the air quality in Patna declined to severe levels, the state government banned the domestic burning of both cow dung and coal, blaming them for the pollution. But without the smoke from the cakes of cow dung to cook and flavor their food, vendors say their dishes will be ruined. Rai said, people visit our stalls just because of special taste. Who would come to us when the food is not tasty? Said Rai, who has been doing a roaring trade since the popular Bollywood actor Amir Khan stopped by his stall in 2012 for a taste of the typical countryside dish. A photograph of Khan tucked into his little chokha, that is stall, still hangs proudly on Rai's stall. The government has promised to supply the vendors with gas canister stoves to replace the traditional fuels, but Rai said gas is no substitute. The ban on coal and cow dung simply means we will have to shut down our business. So, what do you make of that? So, how many of you will be going to India to try Litti Chokha? Wheat flour balls cooked with the special flavor of cow dung flame, smoke and ashes. Wow, sounds very delicious, eh? Someone should open a branch here in Overport. They will become stinking rich. Stinking rich. Well, let's leave it there and ask you a riddle. Let me ask you a riddle. What comes out of a cow and sounds like a bell? what comes out of a cow and sounds like a bell? And the answer is dung. That's a terrible one, isn't it? Ladies, listen carefully. Don't you dare ask the buddy this riddle at lunchtime while his mouth is full of acne, okay? Oh, you ladies are so cruel, eh? Okay, let's stay in India. But first, let me pose this question to you. What would you say is the generally regarded classical language of the Muslims? Of course, we all know the answer, and that is Arabic. Right, it's right across the board in every country that you go. I don't mean that they speak it all the time, perhaps only in the Middle East, but generally Arabic is the classical language of Muslims. And the next question, would you be offended if a university professor who was maybe Christian was teaching Arabic, or even if he was a Hindu, if he was teaching Arabic, would you be offended? Yes, of course. It sounds like a stupid question, and the obvious answer is no. No, you won't be upset at all if anyone of any religious background taught Arabic. But there are really silly people in this world. Listen to this report from New Delhi. It says here, ooh, I seem to have lost it somewhere along the way. Let me see if I can just get to that website very quickly. Nope. I've lost the whole thing. Right, maybe I'll come back to it a little bit later. Again, I'm still looking for it. Yeah. Yeah, found it. Alhamdulillah. A Muslim scholar of Sanskrit has gone into hiding after protests from some right-wing Hindu students claiming that as a Muslim, he cannot teach Sanskrit, the ancient classical language of Hinduism. Firoz Khan, 29 years old, was the unanimous choice of a selection committee at Banaras Hindu University of Varanasi for the post of assistant professor of Sanskrit literature. The committee members were impressed with his erudition, which stems from a childhood passion for the language that continued into further education. But on November 7th, 2 days after Khan took up the post at the university, members of the Akhil Bharatiya Vidyarthi Parishad, a right-wing student organization with a Hindu nationalist ideology, staged a campus protest demanding that Khan be moved to a different faculty. One placard read, "A Muslim cannot teach us our religion." They vowed to keep protesting until Khan was transferred to another post. Khan has been stunned at the protest. His family, his Muslim family, who live in a village not far from Jaipur in Rajasthan, is unusual in that his father, Ramzan Khan, also studied Sanskrit and is famous in the whole area for singing Hindu devotional songs and working as a volunteer in a cow shelter. Hindu priests in the area have come out and supported his son's appointment. Before vanishing, Khan made only a few remarks to the media. "Since my childhood, till the completion of my studies, I never faced any discrimination because of my religion. This is so disheartening. A group of students don't want me to teach them Sanskrit because I am not a Hindu," he told this to the Times of India. Sanskrit is 3,500 years old and has the same status in Hinduism as Latin did in Christianity. I know Muslim teachers were teaching Latin also in school. Anyway, only that it is not quite as dead as Latin. It is still used in some academic and literacy circles, as well as during Hindu and Buddhist religious rituals and ceremonies. So far, the university has stood firm. It issued a statement saying Khan's appointment was final and that it was committed to providing equal opportunities to everyone irrespective of religion, caste, community or gender. But Khan has left the university for the moment. University officials confirmed that he had left on Tuesday to go home for a while and would return when things had calmed down. But when journalists visited his home, Khan was not there, and his father said he did not know his whereabouts. they did not respond to calls from the Guardian newspaper. No minister from the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, that's the BJP, has come out in and support. The Bollywood actor Paresh Rawal, a former BJP MP, who is still affiliated with the party, tweeted, "Stunned by the protest against Professor Firoz Khan, what has language to do with religion?" The irony is Professor Firoz has done his master's and PhD in Sanskrit. For heaven's sake, stop this goddamn idiocy. Meanwhile, other students on the campus have come out in support of Khan and his right to teach Sanskrit, along with some members of Hindu nationalist groups. So, full marks to the university for standing up in defense of Firoz Khan and the Hindu priests who support him. The part that really struck me was this. His father, Ramzan Khan, also studied Sanskrit and is famous in the area for singing Hindu devotional songs and working as a volunteer in a cow shelter. Right, but you know what? In every society, you will get pea-brained loonies, lunatics, who will turn to violence to make the point. Poor Firoz Khan had to leave home. And the worst type is the ones who claim to act in the name of God. Now, let's be very frank. There are nut cases in all religions. Amongst Muslims who put bombs in mosques in Pakistan or marketplaces in Afghanistan and so on, Christian fanatics attacking Muslims, Jewish settlers attacking Palestinians in the West Bank, all in the name of God. Sickening, racist, and religious bigots. Religious bigots! Right, now let's get to more serious matters. I've got some good news for you, and also some bad... Well, let me start that again. I've got some good news for you, and also some good news for you. No, I didn't smoke anything. Listen carefully. I got good news for you. News. What is news? News is the loop you make with a rope to hang someone, right? So there are two nooses that are tightening around the necks of two obnoxious characters. News number one is tightening around the neck of Donald J. Trump. J, of course, stands for Jungli. As you know, his impeachment hearings are taking place right now. Right now. People are appearing at the U.S. Congress hearings to give evidence about Trump's wrongdoings relating to Ukraine. I won't go into that. If you've been listening, last week I spoke about it. So I won't go into that, except to say that the evidence that's coming out steadily and has been coming out for the past few days was extremely damning, very serious stuff. Hence, the news is tightening. Shame. He seems to be quite a lonely figure these days. All those who were close to him, the chamchas and so on, have either jumped ship or were pushed out by him. I don't think he will be fired. His party is strongly supporting him, as I said previously. But it all depends how much dirt will still come out. It's going to be a long process. You know what? I hope he doesn't go. He has really messed things up for America. Better to have a real pugla at the top who destroys America's reputation, America's image, than to have a smart guy like Obama who does dangerous things but makes it look sensible with that big grin of his. And now for news part two. News part two. The rope is tightening around the neck of Benjamin Netanyahu. But before I get into that, let me say this. There are some things that I really marvel at when it comes to Israel. Now, I really got you raising your eyebrows, ne? Raising your eyebrows? What did I say? That I really admire, I really marvel at some of the things that comes out of Israel. Okay, let me explain. I use the word marvel both in a positive and a negative sense. You don't get it, sir? For example, you know, I really marvel at the shenanigans. I really marvel at the fact that Zuma managed to stay out of court for such a long time for his alleged role in state capture. Maybe I should use the word incredulous. I'm totally surprised. So when I use the word marvel, this is what I mean. You got it now, eh? You got it? Okay, good. Don't misunderstand me. So when it comes to Israel, I marvel at the fact that it is a highly innovative country. Now, this is something positive I'm talking about. It's very tiny, Israel. It's got about 7 million people. But it has produced so many inventions. It's technologically so advanced. So many inventions that actually benefit the world. I heard of many such discoveries over the years, but I went to ask Google, Mamali. I put in the words, and you can do so also. I put in the words, list of Israeli inventions and discoveries. Right? List of Israeli inventions and discoveries. Good heavens, did I get one big shock, eh? Big shock. The list was so long that it would take me about 15 minutes at least to go through it. Hundreds of inventions in different categories. Here are some of the areas, some of the categories, and this I'm reading directly from Wikipedia. It says, I don't know, mathematics. It's got like an endless list. Bernstein, Sato, polynomial and the proof of Kasdan, Lustig, conjecture and all big stuff here, which I don't even understand. Automorphic forms and L functions. I don't know what that means. I failed woodwork in school. And when it comes to science, under chemistry alone, discovery of the quasi-crystals by Dan Scheidtman. The discovery led to the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Woo! I'm not going to go through all this. What's it says here? Development of multi-scale models of complex chemical systems. And under physics, prediction of quarks, whatever that is. I don't know if that's what the ducks make, but something called prediction of quarks. Discovery, formulation of black holes by entropy. In the world of optics, and the science, you have optics. A development of the pill cam, which is a tiny capsule, which is used in endoscopy solution to record images of the digestive tract. The capsule is the size and shape of a pill and contains a tiny camera. In the field of medicine, I'm not going to say this is all very complicated. Development of cortisone immunomodulator, a drug for treating multiple sclerosis. There's a whole list here. And the economics also, whole list. Biotechnology, nanowire, a conductive wire made of string of tiny particles of silver. Theoretical computer science, there's a whole list there. And the computer hardware, the USB flash drive, can you believe it? USB flash drive, a flash memory data storage device integrated. Israeli company M Systems developed and manufactured the first USB flash drives. And there's a whole list there. Computer and mobile software. Babylon, a single click computer. Anyway, I don't want to go through the whole list. We're coming to news, ad break, I think, shortly. So, there you are. A whole list of inventions and discoveries by Israeli citizens. Motorola, an American company, produced the first cell phone. I told you about flash drive. Now, this first cell phone, which really surprised me, which, if you remember, at that time was like a heavy brick there, like a door stopper. But all the components for the phone came from Israel. And I just told you about the memory stick. The memory stick was invented in Israel. And so the list goes on, and we'll discuss more after this break. Right, welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture. And like a true mafatia, let me just also get free advertising here about my tours. But mainly to stop people from phoning me, because the Middle East tour is full already. That's in December. The other one in December is Spain and Morocco, full already. And there is one to Vietnam that's also full. Sold out, all of them, except I've got a few seats for India and Kashmir. And just diarize it. We've got trips throughout the year. Next year, that's early in the year, to Bosnia and Croatia. In the middle of the year to Russia. Then we got Uzbekistan. And then we got China. And, I've lost track of all the tours. So just pencil it somewhere. And then we'll get all the ads out and the packages, inshallah. Right, so I was telling you about the technological advancements of Israel and how I marvel at it. You know, you got to give compliments where it is due. And we're talking about the first cell phone and the first memory stick that was. Now, do you know what a startup company is? Startup company. Let me tell you. Two or three guys, usually young guys, university graduates, will have an idea for an invention. They will then look for finance, usually privately, to develop the idea, or they may even go to a financial institution. And if the plan is good, then people will invest in it to develop this idea. Guess how many startups there are right now in Israel? More than 6,000 right now. And as I said, when an idea is fully worked out, completed, then companies, especially in America, they rush to pay millions of dollars to buy these startups. Israel is a beehive of activity of technological development. There you are. I marvel at this. I make no apologies about that. And then the sad parts. The Arab world has a combined population of 422 million. So, what have they produced over the past 100 years? And they've got the money, because billions of dollars were pouring out of the ground in the way of oil. How much have they don't need startup capital? Come on, tell me, what have they produced by way of invention, technological advancement? There must be something. Tell me, someone, anyone? I'm waiting. No. Don't tell me about the good old days, the golden age when Arab scientists and philosophers and they discovered all kinds of things, algebra and lenses that we used to see in our glasses. That was a long time ago. And yes, of course, we are proud of that. Go to Spain, you'll hear all these the luminaries, what they discovered and so. But over the past 100 years, what did we produce in the Arab world? Let me leave you to ponder that. So whether you like it or not, whether you hate Israel or not, when it comes to just to this specific thing about discoveries and inventions, Israel is the leading country in the world proportionate to its size, to its population of just around 7 million. There's no argument there at all. The next thing I marvel at, and this is in a negative sense, you're following me now, right? In a negative sense, how they managed to capture first the British and then the Americans to support their projects 100 years ago of setting up their own country in a far-off place called Palestine. First, they got the British government, in particular, a minister in the government, Lord Balfour, to give them a written undertaking that they have a right to set up a homeland in Palestine. And Britain wasn't even there, wasn't even in charge of Palestine, and had nothing to do with Palestine at that time. But they had foresight, you see, foresight. The Jews, the Zionists. And a few years later, when Britain did take over Palestine, this letter was used as a visa, and hundreds, thousands of Jews from Europe poured into Palestine. Foresight and planning. Highly motivated to reach a goal. You get it? Highly motivated to reach a goal. Then they went over to America and got the American government to endorse their project. And so Israel was established. Now, of course they knew, they realized that there would be huge objection, hostility from the Arab world and many other countries to this Israeli project. So they captured, they got under control the superpower. That's the US of A, United States of America. Once you do that, you don't have to worry about all the other countries. Long as you got America on your side, 100%. You know, as I often quote a former congressman, Pat Buchanan, he said that the US Congress is Israeli-occupied territory. All over America, there are very powerful, well-financed groups that are called lobbies that make sure that no one criticizes Israel. Try to get the book. Let me see if I can give you the name of the book. The name of the book. The Israeli Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy is a book by John Mearsheimer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, and Stephen Walt, Professor of International Relations at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Top boys, these. Top boys. Professors at leading institutions, leading universities. And this was published in late August 2007, and it was a New York Times bestseller, and it was exposing the work of the lobby on American politics. This book will give you a good idea about how the U.S. government is captured. Incidentally, the U.S. donates about $4 billion every year to Israel, one of the most well-developed countries in the region. Even the media is almost firmly in the grip of the various lobbies, such as CAMERA, C-A-M-E-R-A, Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America. So this is just a brief idea of how the pro-Israel lobbies in America ensures that there must be little or no criticism of Israel. For example, when it bombs Gaza and dozens are killed and hundreds injured, the U.S. media will focus almost completely on the rockets fired from Gaza that kill no one. There is one more aspect to this. That's why I gave you this whole introduction, something which I've spoken repeatedly over the years about the influence of the lobby. Now, there's something else that I came across that really surprised me. Let me read brief extracts from an article on the excellent, excellent website known as Mondovice. Mondovice. You should M-O-N-D-O-W-E-I-S-S. Go there and you'll read some brilliant article about what's happening in Palestine. And the headline of this article is, "When Israel's military begins to attack, so does its army of online trolls." What are trolls? Those people are there to check on what's happening online and somehow try to contribute to it. The article says, ACT.IL is a global pro-Israel campaign, at least partially funded by the country's government. The project includes an app that enables users to earn points and prizes for promoting the state of Israel online by attacking BDS and other pro-Palestinian movements. According to Electronic Intifada, which is another website, reporting from earlier this year, it is operating with a budget of more than $1 million. Michael Buchert is a PhD student in sociology and political economy at Carleton University, and since April 2018, he's maintained a Twitter account that tracks the app's mission. Now, you know what's an app? The thing you download onto your cell phone or your computer, an application. So he's been checking on what is called missions. It's called ACT.IL and was set up in a sort of partnership between the Israeli government and a number of American pro-Israeli lobby groups funded by Sheldon Adelson. Who is he? He's a multi-billionaire, and he's got many gambling outfits all over the U.S. So the article says, but basically it's an app which anyone in the world can download onto their phone, and it identifies targets online, or they call them missions, in which pro-Israel individuals can very easily participate in online discourse. So it will identify a tweet for them to read, or it will identify a Facebook comment on a news article they can like. Essentially, it's a way of coordinating online behavior in a way that looks organic, but is actually quite choreographed by this sort of centralized body with support from the Israeli government. And yet the intention of it is to very suddenly shape online discourse in a way that's pro-Israel. So these people are all watching what's happening online in Facebook and Twitter and everywhere else. There are usually a number of missions for the app directing users to comment on their Instagram post or welcome them to Israel on Twitter, that kind of thing, to sort of combat any boycott pressure they might be receiving. Then you have a whole category of more serious or consequential missions. Missions means projects, where it's really targeting a specific local issue, usually on a campus, university campus, where they might target a special conference or a specific set of students in a way that makes it appear there is a backlash to pro-Palestinian organizing in an organic sense. That means like innocently, people are just picking up these things here and there and therefore objecting to pro-Palestinian activity. But it's all very well organized. So so when it's actually choreographed, in some cases, the app has boasted of getting people fired or of getting things cancelled. So when it puts a target on a local issue, it can really have a big impact. And this guy says, and I think the time when you see the most activity is times like right now, when there is an escalation of violence, especially with airstrikes on Gaza and corresponding rocket fire. That's when you have a fairly massive response with a whole range of missions all at once. Missions means attacks or projects to deal with this. And whether or not, again, there is an upstick in actual users taking advantage of this mission, I don't know, but certainly the app is far more active in these times. So there you have it, folks. Pro-Israel people around the world download the app, and when anything that's critical of Israel is detected anywhere in the world, the whole group is alerted to take action. Brilliant, isn't it? Brilliant. So what did I tell you? I marvel at how highly motivated the Zionists and the supporters are. Highly, highly motivated in action and also putting their money where their mouths are. If they were not so highly motivated, then Israel would not have been established, in my view. Or if it was created, then it would have disappeared a long time ago, given its clear contravention of human rights and international law. Ah, yes, international law. Donald Trump, when he was becoming president, said that he has a peace plan for Israel. He called it the deal of the century. A peace process deal like never before, according to Donald. Well, it's 2 years now, and we're still waiting for this peace deal to be born. But in the 2 years, his peace deal is very clear. He has been given Israel piece by piece of more and more of Palestinian land, piece by piece. First, he awarded the whole of the Jerusalem to Israel. Then he gave Israel Syria's Golan Heights. And now he says that the illegal settlements throughout the West Bank, there's about 200 of them, housing 600,000 settlers, recognized as these settlements as illegal by the whole world. It's against international law. It's now, well, according to Trump or the U.S. administration, now okay for Israel to annex, take over these settlements and make it part of Israel. And some say the municipal boundaries of these settlements gobbles up 40% of the West Bank. So Donald has been doing all of this to help his friend Bibi Netanyahu to stay in power. You know, Bibi can say, see what I did for you, Israeli society. But that doesn't seem to be working. Last week I told you that there were elections in Israel and no party managed to get enough members of parliament in order to form a government. So there could be another election soon to settle this big, big crisis. But for Netanyahu, there's a bigger crisis. And here's another thing that I marvel at about Israel. When it comes to its citizens, and here I am excluding the 20% of Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, Israeli law goes for them no matter how high up they are. Whoever you are, no matter how high up. Ehud Olmert, Israel's former prime minister, was sentenced to 27 months for fraud. Moshe Katsav, former president, 7 years for rape and other sexual offenses. And now we have Bibi Netanyahu, who has just been charged with bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in three corruption cases. Now, I don't want to get into the details, but the noose is tightening around his neck. Trump and Netanyahu both claim that these charges are politically motivated, and that they didn't do any wrong, and that just the enemies have all... These are all trumped-up charges. And many commentators are saying that Trump will survive because his party is well completely behind him. And of course, Netanyahu is a survivor, a tough guy. He may survive also. So maybe the news won't be effective. Maybe it won't tighten. Maybe there won't be any new news. Now, what's that expression? No news is good news. Okay, you can laugh, you can laugh. So, this got me thinking about charges against Netanyahu. Apparently, Bibi granted some favors to media website tycoons in return for them reporting favorably about him. Wow, serious stuff, right? Big stuff. And I wondered about what's been happening here in South Africa. A great democracy. A great democracy. It's more like a great kleptocracy. Stealing left, right and center. Corruption. Every day we hear about new chorwans uncovered, stealing millions, millions and millions down the drain. Headline this week, hawks arrest 10 over 600 million toilet tender in Eastern Cape. Hawks arrest 10 over 600 million toilet tender in Eastern Cape. 600 million rands? Huh? Money for sheer alleviating the plight of the poor. Now, I like this story. This story really had me falling off my chair. Bruce Koloane is said to have given permission to the Guptas to land their wedding plane at Waterkloof Airport Base. Big scandal. Huge. Koloane said he was very sorry. So he faced some disciplinary process, and he was then suspended for 2 months. Eh? He was suspended for 2 months, and then he came back as Deputy Director General of the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, DIRCO. DIRCO. Wonderful, isn't it? Came back as Deputy Director General of the Department of Inland Relations and Cooperation. And you know what? It gets better. The minister at that time, Maite Nkwana Mashabane, then recommended to Jacob Zuma that Bruce Koloane becomes the next ambassador to the Netherlands. To the Netherlands. And Zuma confirmed it, made him the ambassador. Speaking at the Zondo Commission, Mashabane explained that she did not... In her written statement, this is what she said, that she did not mention that Koloane did bad things. She didn't, in her recommendation to Jacob Zuma, she didn't mention the bad things that Koloane. And Mashabane said, and she was asked by Judge Zondo whether she said this to Jacob Zuma, and she said no, she didn't put in a report, but she did chat to Zuma about it later, and it was his decision solely to say yes or no to send Koloane as ambassador to the Netherlands. Listen here, people. Listen here. What kind of circus are we living in, eh? People do very bad things and they become ambassadors. It's a circus. And I read a brilliant piece yesterday that put the whole circus into perspective. Let me go through it very quickly. And this article is by Prince Machiel. He's a columnist. And he said, after stealing all eggs, ANC cadres now going after the chicken itself. Let me see how much I can get through here. The circus currently unfolding at the South African Airways is a microcosm of a bigger endgame of ANC corruption and incompetence. Like other state-owned companies, SAA has been looted to the ground by a succession of ANC cadres or cadres. Ask anyone who has access to procurement information there and you will be shocked by how much the airline has been paying for a simple bottle of water. When corruption takes place, it first comes across as if it is a case of historically deprived ANC cadres benefiting duly from procurement process that used to benefit white suppliers. Those who complain about corruption are dismissed and projected as envious agents of white monopoly capital who are unhappy that black people are having their turn at the table. When critics become louder, they are told to shut up and reminded arrogantly by the eating cadres that there was corruption under apartheid. When the cadres don't tell the public, what the cadres don't tell the public is that under apartheid, white people did not steal to the extent of collapsing institutions that were meant to serve their own people. It was theft with a conscience. The ANC cadres are so primitive that after stealing all the eggs, they proceed to steal even the chicken itself. The whole sordid affair is wrapped up in a stinky blanket written, Black Economic Empowerment. Sometimes on the blanket is written, Affirmative Action. As the eating continues, in the name of black people, Statistics South Africa issues numbers that make it plain that the economic condition of black people in general are worsening. When education collapses, white people simply build private schools for their children. When hospitals degenerate, whites build private hospitals for themselves. And by the way, nobody must blame them. After 1994, white people did not collapse any school or hospital. The tragic comedy of the whole thing is that after looting from the state, ANC cadres take the money to pay for world-class services in the private sector, the same services built by white people. The cadres send their children to white schools, and when they are sick, the cadres go to white people's private hospitals. In the case of SAA, the burden of corruption is now thrown on the shoulders of workers who were not invited to the table when ANC cadres were still eating. The unfortunate thing is that ordinary workers are now made to appear as if they are making unreasonable demands to a company that has no money. People are not asking where the money has gone. Somebody with a sharp investigative eye must go around looking for the assets of all previous SAA executives. Such a thorough investigation will most probably reveal that the 8% wage increase demanded by the workers is a drop in the ocean compared to the cumulative money stolen by ANC cadres. Workers cannot be absolved of all culpability, though. Where were they when ANC cadres were looting these state-owned enterprises? Does anyone remember any trade union announcing the mother of all strikes against corruption? The sad truth is that the South African state is now bankrupt. President Cyril Ramaphosa announced in Parliament this year using the euphemistic phrase, "Our resources are now depleted." It is now too late. It does not matter whether workers choose to stage a father or mother of all strikes. ANC cadres have stolen all the eggs and all the chickens. Workers should have staged protests when the cadres were busy stealing the eggs before they turned to chickens. The problem with public discourse in South Africa is that it always focuses on parts, not the whole picture. The whole thing now is projected as if it is an SAA problem. The bigger truth, though, is that SAA is a small manifestation of the end game of a generalized ANC corruption and incompetence. Behold, the grand collapse is afoot. As things continue to fall apart, expect more gimmicks in the form of investment conferences that make pledges while more and more South Africans lose their job. There you are. Prince Mashele. Wow. Saying it like it is. Right. Let me see if I can dig up something from the light at the end of the tunnel graveyard. Act like you didn't hear this before and laugh loudly at the end. I went to visit my friend Gulamba in Mirbank. As I went to his front gate, two big vicious dogs came up. I called Gulamba. I said, "Hey, when you got these dogs?" And he said, "Last week." "Hey, the crime is very high here in our area." I said, "What are their names?" And he said to me, "One is called Rolex and the other one is called Timex." I said, "Hey, what kind of names are those for dogs, eh? What kind of names?" And he said, "Hey, what's wrong with that? They are watchdogs." That's it. Dry one, right? You didn't laugh? Okay, let's try this one. Again, Gulambai from Mirbank, his son Yusuf is gone for Hajj. And Gulambai wants to know the time difference between Durban and Makkah. So he phones Telkom's international calls department. And Gulambai says, "Can you tell me, please, What is the difference in time between Durban and Makkah in Saudi Arabia? And the operator says, 1 second, please. And Ghulam Bhai says, thank you very much, and puts the phone down. Last one, I don't know if I did this recently. Ronnie asked his son, Indran, what he learnt in school today. And Indran answers, Dad, I learnt about the idea of give and take. And Ronnie said, oof, I'm proud of you, son. Tell me more. And Indran answers, I gave Selvan a punch and I took his lunch. Well, we're going to be crossing over to Al Ansar for part two of the big picture. So if you are in the Durban area, stay tuned. This is Abid Awji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.